You know, I light myself on fire. I put myself in these situations that are really precarious and survive them, I think, as a way of kind of reaffirming my ability to live.
Hello, and welcome to Fuck Yeah, the podcast where we say fuck yeah to art as social commentary. I am one of your hosts, Sarah, and I am joined by my maybe slightly heavy co-host, Robin.
How you doing?
Yeah. I'm okay. You know, it's just like with everything that's going on in my life, it's just like a real up and down roller coaster. So yesterday was really difficult, but like I would say my fuck yeah today would be just like the magic of friends, you know. It was a really difficult day where there was multiple times where I like flipped out, you know, on my own, not on anybody or anything, but like, you know, at one point I was like trying to work and it was just so hard emotionally and because of all the other things going on, not because of the work. But so I was like, all right, just take a shower, like do some somatic reset. Like a hot shower really works for me usually. And I get in the shower and it just almost like allowed things to come out more. And I went into like a kind of rage cry, growling, screaming, like trying not to alarm my neighbors, kind of, you know. I was like actually snarling, you know, and it didn't really make me feel better to get it out. Like I just kind of felt even more activated. And then throughout that day, I ended up seeing multiple people, multiple friends, good friends. And I was able to, you know, walk with a good friend, and you know, walking is always so great. And then I was performing, or not performing, but rehearsing a performance with friends, and that really took me out.
Yes,
to be with friends making artwork. By the time I got home, I was like, yes, that's what I needed. Now I'm not obsessing, I'm not ruminating, I'm not raging against something that I can't change, you know. So, yeah, fuck yeah to fucking friends, because these relationships, I've never valued them more or been able to see the value of them so greatly, because like hard times, like it's really important to get out there and socialize, even if you're not talking about what's going on with you, but and making the art, making things with people, real collaboration is so joyful. So yeah, friends and art.
It's kind of like unselfing, like we were talking about.
That's so true. That's right. Yeah, gosh.
I think that this is, you're speaking to part of, you know, a number of things that have come up over the course of this season when we've had discussions about the problematic nature of creating these hierarchies of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that intimate relationships and nuclear family are the top priority, and that's where you orient yourself and how you can kind of lose sight of yourself in that process. Mm-hmm. But also, I just don't think, I mean, I think as queer people, we have really close friendships and chosen family, and it is a pressing urge to have those relationships and to nurture them. But it's also really working against the tide, right? To keep your friendships front and center and put as much energy into them. But they are the thing that can catch you sometimes when everything else kind of falls apart or fails or...
100%. And I think actually, you know, like a lot of the deep conversations that we just have on the regular is like, you know, the psychedelic conversations. I do think being in relationship with queer people has quickened the dissolving of my, you know, quote unquote straight relationship. because mm-hmm. there is an ability to see one another and accept one another and to really listen and lesbian process that just by comparison, I'm like, I started feeling unfulfilled because I am getting things from my friends that is just seems beyond what I can get from this other relationship. What I've experienced with queer people is so much, has been very deep and meaningful.
Yeah.
You know, on a level that I haven't experienced in other places, to be honest. And maybe that's just happenstance, but it does seem pretty, it's been consistent for me, and I'm so appreciative of those relationships. They're really keeping me going right now.
I'm just glad that you're feeling held.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is without me really asking to be held or supported. And one of my friends yesterday was like, you know, you could ask for that. You could ping the group text. And I'm like, they'll show up. I know they will. I'm good right now. I didn't ping the text because I think I would get overwhelmed, to be honest. I think I would be like, okay, guys, I need a little space. I don't have time in my schedule for this many coffees and hugs, you know? So that's literally the reason why I haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So thank you, everyone.
I feel like today's episode is such a nice end to this season for us because we have Castles joining us, who is known in the art world as an absolute powerhouse, and whose art has, you know, personally impacted me significantly. I am such a huge fan, but we've also been friends with Castles for many years. And so it is nice to have some queer fam coming onto the podcast to help us close out season 3. And I think that this is going to be just a really enlightening and deep conversation.
Mm-hmm. You can't not go deep with Castles.
Yeah.
And also you're totally right. It's like even right now we're talking about friends and performance art and, you know, and queerness, and it's all like meshed, you know, together.
And for anyone who is not familiar with Castles, Castles is a performance artist. I mean, I would say that Castles has actually really cracked the code on making art in many mediums. So you can interact with Castles' art in a number of different ways. And Castle's work contemplates the history of LGBTQIA+ violence, representation, struggle, and survival. For Castle's, performance is a form of social sculpture. So, I mean, that's, you know, we're gonna get deep, y'all. And they're drawing from the idea that bodies are formed in relation to forces of power and social expectations. And so in Castle's work, you're gonna see them really centering their body in the work. And it's fucking powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I am so excited to get into this conversation and just talk about the evolution of their art and their work and how it's evolving and all the things.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've had a good conversation with Castles. They kind of moved away over in Toronto now, and I'm excited to see where they are even viewing where art is at today and in the state of politics and everything, because those are always really meshed together for them. So I can't wait to get into this conversation.
Let's bring them on.
Welcome, Castles. We're so excited to have you here. Thanks for making the time. How's it going today?
It's going pretty well, thank you. Yeah, I'm doing well. I'm happy to be here. Excited to be here with you all.
Good. We want to throw a few warm-up questions at you first. We're wondering, what's the last photo on your phone?
That is a really good question.
It's always a mystery. No one ever knows.
Ooh, it's very boring. It's a photograph of a taxi receipt. But prior to that, earlier this morning, is a photo of me shirtless with a really beautiful fuzzy scarf on that I sent to my girlfriend. That's it.
I love that.
Yeah, cold and cold and hot simultaneously.
That's hence the scarf.
Indeed, you know, just keep that neck warm and you'll be good.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. How? I mean, we weren't going to get too into this, and you totally don't need to discuss this at all. But how are you enjoying your new changes in your torso?
Oh, you know, I was just thinking about that. So interesting. I did an artist talk last night at the John Daniels School of Architecture at the University of Toronto last night for like a public seminar. And I was speaking with a trans artist after the talk. And he said, you know, how is it that you grapple with your dysphoria when your body is represented so heavily in your work? Mm. You know, and I just told him it's something I contend with on the daily. Mm. And we were kind of reflecting on this notion that actually a trans elder, an amazing legendary photographer, Della Grace Volcano, told me years ago when I was in my 20s, and I asked him then, you know, should I medically transition? Like, has this changed your life? And he said to me, wherever you go, there you are. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that was very true of my discussion with this trans artist last night as well. He said, you know, it's never enough. The dysphoria does not go away, mm-hmm. you know? And he said that he had to choose between losing his codifiable identity markers that made him read as queer to then become someone who read as a cis male, mm. or spend the rest of his life enraged. And that was the kind of choice that he had to make. Mm. For myself, I think I feel like I do feel less dysphoria, you know, having the surgery that I've had. The surgery I had is like an unusual surgery. It's not a double mastectomy. It's actually, I saw this doc and he was like, look, you essentially have a male chest with a bit of breast tissue. You look like a classic candidate for a gynomastasia procedure. So I actually had a procedure done for gynomastasia. So I don't have the same scars, nor do I have the kind of perfect like male chest with the nipples in the right place. So I feel like my surgery is still very queer. And it doesn't quite, I don't really pass still, but at least my chest is flatter. And I do like that, you know, I do like that. But the scars are quite gnarly and ugly still. Mm-hmm. But whatever, I'm just a wall of scars. I got scars all over my body at this point. Right. It's just like battle wounds, man. You know, right. So all this to say, like, it's something that I think about, but I don't really believe in that traditional notion of like, emancipation through becoming yourself, through making these superficial alterations through the medical industrial complex and shelling out enough cash to like just get the right amount of silicone injected or the right like cc's of hormones like dumped into your system, then all of a sudden you too will be free. Like I am suspicious of that narrative.
Yeah, because here you are still.
Here I am still.
Yeah. It's like when you go, it's not like this, but it reminds me a little bit of like when you're on vacation and you're like, oh, and here I am on vacation now. It's like me in another location.
Yeah. I'm still having an existential crisis under a palm tree. Yeah.
Right.
Very much so. Yeah.
Who was your first celebrity crush?
Madonna.
Yes. I'm going to see her tomorrow. I can't wait.
I saw that. I've never seen her in concert. I saw her here in Toronto. That tour is insane. It's so like, she has no dramaturge. It's like Madonna being like, this is it. It's my last hurrah. I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want.
Yeah.
She really, really does. And it's like, I loved it. The dancers are so insane. I mean, that's one thing Madonna does very well. Mm-hmm. She brings like a crew of like current talent that are like plugged in and tapped into the here and now. And so like every single person she has with her on tour is like exceptionally talented. You just got to hand it to her. She's like in her 70s. She's up in like a cage above a stadium, like dry ice, just like hair blowing and a cat suit. I'm like, that is what I want to be, you know, or maybe something like that. But like, but yes, well, I had a poster of her from like the, Lucky Star original 1984 album. And there was like, she had like the hat on and like, you could see her cleavage. And I would just like sit on the staircase of my parents' basement and like stare at her cleavage. for hours. I could get lost in her cleavage. So there you go. That was my first
one. I love that. You know, we don't actually get, we ask this of every guest, and we don't get that many repeats. And there's, I remember there's been one other Madonna, and it was Pony Lee.
You know, we're the same generation. Makes sense. Like she's hot. Mind.
Right. Let's see. What was your first mode of masturbation?
Humping a pillow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I also would get caught a lot doing like art things on girls' genitals. Like this is also an early thing for me. Like age.
Oh boy.
Yeah, age.
What do you mean art things?
Well, like for example, like I just remember these moments of getting very shamed for like sexual mm-hmm. play. And one was my next door neighbor. I must have been under four because I was living in Toronto still. And I had found this like beautiful shade of turquoise house paint in my friend Emily's father's like, you know, garage. And I had found like this nice thick brush and I convinced her to pull down her pants and I just like painted her pussy like turquoise, like a big stripe. And I got in big trouble for that. And then I had I remember this girl, Jennifer, had a Crayola, marker tower. Do you remember those? They kind of
scale
up all the rainbow colors kind of.
Yes.
Anyways, I did like a pointillist design on her pussy with like all of these colors. It was like very beautiful. And I also got hella busted for that. And
oh my God. You were you from the very beginning.
I was so much.
Can I just, all right, point out the connections between particularly the turquoise painting and Human Measure? I mean, that's not quite turquoise, but it's a shade of blue and there's nakedness and wow.
Yep.
Mm-hmm, straight line. That's a straight line from one to the other. That's a journey. Mm-hmm, I love
it. It's true.
Do you have any fuck yeahs right now?
I was recently showing this film called United in Anger by Jim Hubbard to my students. And that's, you know, we were discussing the immune system. We're going through this class called The Body where we look at different systems of the body. And the immune system was a chance for us to look at the AIDS crisis. And this film, United in Anger, is made up entirely of documents that were made by folks that were directly impacted by the AIDS crisis in the Reagan administration. And their protest tactics were so innovative and so just powerful, and the sort of sexiness of ACT UP, you know, and also not only just ACT UP, but all the other organizations that proliferated around ACT UP that often don't get named because they're not heroic white men.
Right.
But, you know, like just like thinking about like the protest tactics of that, but then also like legendary downtown New York poet Pamela Sneed, who's like a radical black lesbian, and her series of poems, Funeral Divas, which are all about like how fabulous she was. She's like 6'2" and one of the most amazing orators I've ever seen. And because of this, when she was alive in her prime during the AIDS crisis, she was invited to orate at funerals. And so she called herself a funeral diva. And her recent book, which is a selection of poems, like which basically recount her experiences of being at these funerals and orating on behalf of these dead, gay, mostly BIPOC folks, you know, who are directly impacted. Like those two sort of references have been, you know, giving me a lot of inspiration. And so I would say that they are inspiring my fuck yeah.
Yeah, I love that. That's powerful.
That ties into some things that we want to talk to you about today in your work. This is a theme that's actually come up a fair amount in this season. But I want to first kind of orient to how you use your body in your work. And so for people who are not familiar with your art, you have sculpted your body through performance. You've put your body through strain, endurance, surveillance. You've used your bodily waste as a sculpture. So did you always know that you wanted your body to be the instrument through which you commented on the power structures and your own identity? Or what was the journey to get there for you?
I think my journey started, you know, I did not come from a family that really was exposing me to contemporary art. But I've always been an artist, you know, ever since I was a small child. I started drawing before I could speak. And
sometimes on other kids. Sorry.
Yes, sometimes on other kids.
Right.
I didn't really have a lot of affirmation or sort of counterpoints to that. You know, I did have a pretty supportive art school instructor in high school, which I was really lucky to have. She was lovely, but not much representation, and also like zero queer representation. Like I never met a queer person until my 20s, you know? Wow. I didn't know that really was possible or existed. And so I think both my art and my sexuality and my gender identity were quite limited based on the sort of experiences that I was exposed to, you know? And I stumbled into an undergraduate degree at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, which is not well known in the United States, but in Canada, it is known to have been a hotbed of conceptual performance and experimentation, mostly because it was formed by a lot of draft-dodging Americans who were escaping the Vietnam War and came up to Halifax, Nova Scotia, to experiment in the middle of nowhere with like not a lot of pressure. And so a lot of very important artists were there, like Martha Rosler, Martha Wilson, Vito Acconci, like people who are like quite kind of legendary conceptual artists by, you know, in today's canon. And so little naive me like wandered in at age 18, wanting to paint, having done nothing but representational work my whole life, because that's all I thought you could be as an artist, wasn't someone who worked in representation, and was exposed to a vast bastion of experimental practices and the idea of like making works that resonated outside of the confines of gallery spaces, of institutional spaces, of elite spaces, and thinking about the body as a more immediate way in which to generate and convey an idea, something that kind of was direct, wasn't about having necessarily an understanding of our history. You know, there's just a direct sort of transmission that happens between bodies in live performance. And I think I was really compelled by that. But I'd say also what influenced me was when I was young, I had a really terrible illness that lasted from age 9 to 14. Mm-hmm. And I almost died. When I was 14, I had like a serious complicated surgery because I was also told that my illness was psychosomatic my whole life.
Oh, right.
So, I was suffering incredibly and very, very sick, but was being told that there was nothing wrong with me. And I had to go to school anyways, and I had to keep my grades up, and I had to perform. And I was suffering like physically greatly, and no one would listen to me. So it took for me to almost die for adults to listen to me. And I think that did a couple of things. It enforced in me a strong sense that I know my body. And I don't, I need to have agency and understanding, and not necessarily control, but like a deep understanding of the body. And it really planted in me a desire to want to understand how to heal, how to listen and how to heal my body and hence the bodies of others, which kind of begat my 23 years as a trainer and specifically working with trans and non-binary community in that context, you know, and I think it also gave me a healthy sort of skepticism of the medical industrial complex. And so I'd say that both those things led me to the body, both the examples of like what artists can do with the body and how the body can be such a direct message for change. And then also like my own experience with having realized that my body was something that was contested, that was something capable of transformation, the sort of power and agency that's held within the body when one like kind of fosters a relationship of empowerment to the body. And that could be a sort of template and a way to think about, social change and change through art.
Yeah. That's so interesting, that perspective, and really knowing you is just your daily life is a conversation of what you're talking about with your body. It's your daily life is so oriented around these concepts around knowing oneself and health and, you know, you do a lot of like food magic in a way, like the way that you eat is so important to you and the way that you use your body just in the day to day and you're working out and the bodybuilding and sculpting your body, all of these things. And there's this, this quote that I saw of yours where you were talking about your trans identity and how it's this, rather than switching from one to the other, it's this continual becoming, I think is what you're quoted as. And I just find this like such a relief because it's about this constant growth and journey and discovery rather than I am this one thing and now I'm this other thing. And I was just wondering, like, where are you at with your identity right now? Where are you at on this journey? Like on this continuum, and I think it kind of possibly how you would kind of reflect it towards what's going on with transness in the culture in general or trans identity.
I think that, you know, transness is a continuum, mm-hmm. and I believe in the sort of spasm and slipperiness of it, mm-hmm. and I think that due to my relationship to not really trusting big pharma, mm-hmm. and having had, you know, a surgery that almost killed me, mm-hmm. I was scared to have surgery, and I did have surgery last November. And I have to say, like, it was so incredible to have that surgery because I didn't wake up thinking like, oh, I had a gender affirming surgery. I woke up thinking like, I'm alive. Mm-hmm. I'm alive. And I realized that this sort of fear of death that I experienced when I was 14 has been something that has completely marked my entire trajectory. Wow. You know, I light myself on fire. I put myself in these situations that are really precarious and survive them, I think, as a way of kind of reaffirming my ability to live, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that surgery was no exception. So I would say that I identify as like more trans masculine, but mm-hmm. because of the sort of reservations I have about like full hormonal interventions, and you know, I also understand that there are certain aspects of me that won't pass, you know, so I get misgendered pretty constantly, which is annoying, and it happens mm-hmm. a lot more in Canada, mm-hmm. a lot more in Canada. It's one of the reasons I'm leaving. Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think it's because progressively, politically, Canada is way more advanced. Like you'll go to you can go to like a random yoga studio and they'll have non-binary bathrooms, or they'll say like men and people that identify as men, like on, you know, it's kind of amazing and progressive. So that's there in terms of the legislation, but the average person doesn't really have the understanding of how to read that. And they still kind of view you as man or woman. And so I get, you know, misgendered a lot up here, and I find that really difficult. So, you know, as I was saying earlier in the warm-up question, I think it's something that I continue to deal with. I think, you know, it is something that is always evolving, and I think our relationship to gender changes. Right now, if anything, what I'm feeling more than anything else is just kind of the sense of being a bit older, you know, mm-hmm. and you know what it is to work with youth all day long, who are, you know, early like in their late teens and early 20s, mm-hmm. who are coming in to their own identities, and they're so, in some ways, so much more advanced than I could have ever have hoped to imagine to have been at their age. Mm-hmm. Like it was just not even there and impossible. So I see the continuum as well as being in relationship to like intergenerationality as it relates to transness. And, you know, I think a lot about my role and my goal right now is to be able to model a space where they can be expansive, mm-hmm. and do the sort of imagining of the things that I can't even that can't even form in my brain because I'm so conditioned. Yeah. But I know that by just being there for them and opening that space for them, that they will bring me forward with them where they go. So I really see that like my role as a trans person is to just kind of hold that space for youth right now. Yeah, and to also remind them of a time, because all of us came up in a time where we were moving toward, I mean, of course it was neoliberal, and of course, you know, we could poke many problems with it, and there was systemic racism and sexism and misogyny and transphobia and xenophobia and all of that. That was all there. But like post 2016, things are very dark in this country. And these young people don't remember a time where it wasn't like that. And, and we all grew up in a time where we were moving towards progress. It was very hard for us to imagine the circumstances that we're under. So I'm also there to remind them of those times, to show them the strategies that my elders took, you know, towards abolition, towards the peace movement, towards reproductive justice, towards towards racial justice, towards gender equality, and for them to look at those lessons from like the 60s and the 70s and to think about how that relates to the here and now.
Oh, gosh, this has me thinking of my brain is going in so many different directions. The historical context of what we came up in, the challenge, the struggle, it's just so completely different. So, of course, the ways in which we relate to our identity, to each other, the expectations that we have for progress, these sorts of things are going to be really different. Something that has come up a lot this season, particularly for us in conversation, has been this historical moment that we're in, that it's simultaneously feels like this flashpoint that is absolutely going to be documented in history books, but that we also have so much repetition of a lost history. Because we have, you know, moments in time like the fascist Nazis who just absolutely wiped out all queer culture. You have the AIDS epidemic where we lost so much so many people, but also that passing down of intergenerational knowledge. And so knowing that a lot of your work presents current issues in relation, or at least within a historical context, what are the issues right now that are most calling to you, that you think are the most pressing?
I mean, I really like this concept of like history not repeating, but it rhymes. And so, you know, I've always looked to strategies invoked by artists from the past to template my actions in the future. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I didn't really have a lot of creative role models or queer role models. So I literally study and see what was done and think about, you know, how can I take that concept and make it relevant to now? You know, as Shakespeare said, there's nothing new under the sun. Right? Mm-hmm. So it's really about how we recontextualize these strategies and kind of tweak them and reevaluate them for the here and now. For me, what's most heavy and pressing is obviously Gaza right now. There is, I really struggle with the fact that there is a real time genocide being funded by our tax dollars. And it's actually unlike anything ever before in that it is unveiling itself on social media constantly. You know, you can watch firsthand experience of people showcasing their lives being actively destroyed. You know, I think what I'm thinking about a lot is like, how is it that we get past these sort of polemics and righteousness into a space of deep listening, into a space of collective liberation? And how do we kind of have these very difficult conversations in a moment of incredible violence? You know, like this violence needs to stop. Like it just, it doesn't matter like the reasonings behind these things. Like what is happening needs to stop, you know? So I think, you know, I was at a march in New York City last Saturday for Gaza, and I know there was one in LA too that you went to, Sarah, social media. It was raining cats and dogs, and so I had an umbrella like everybody else, and I thought there was maybe like 1,000 people there because I couldn't see because of my umbrella. There were 50,000 people there.
Wow.
You know, and I really think that we have been siloed into difference mm-hmm. as an organizing strategy of ignorance
yeah.
by large mm-hmm. powers, and that it is our duty to focus our solidarity. And that doesn't mean that we're all the same. I'm not right. talking about a horizontalization of identity. I'm not saying like, oh, like you're just like me, or like that we should transparently be able to read each other and that all humans are the same. No, we're not. We're mm-hmm. remarkably different. There's tremendous inequality in the mm-hmm. world, and we have remarkably different experiences. But I'm thinking that we have to actually embrace the fact that we can't see each other, not boil each other down to a mode of transparency, and regardless, like, take part in movements of solidarity building. Like, for me, that is like key if we want to have a future. And so that's really what I'm thinking about. And I'm not sure, like, Gaza is not something that directly shows up in my work because I'm not Palestinian, mm-hmm. you know? But I think what I can do is be in solidarity. And mm-hmm. and certainly I am doing that, both in my personal work and even in like the sort of business aspects of my art, you know? But I'm also being cognizant to not take up space on a platform that's not really about centering me. Yeah, so that's really what's on my mind. And then, of course, you know, we're living under the most egregious attacks on trans rights in the history of this country. Mm-hmm. We have over 461 bills, anti-trans bills in the state legislatures in 41 separate states happening right now. And it's a completely, there's like a kind of incredible dissonance, and it's spreading north here in Alberta, Canada. Our premier here just passed a law that mirrors the laws in Texas and in Florida. Even going so far as that a minor has to have permission from their parents to use a pronoun that they feel comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So it's really devastating. And then you look at like the sort of effects of that, as demonstrated by Nex Benedict's recent mm-hmm. murder in a high school bathroom committed by girls. Mm-hmm. You know, girls historically have not done these kinds of things. So like the kind of hate, and that's the direct relationship of Kevin Snitt, the governor of that state, passing legislation in public schools saying that children can only use the bathrooms that match the gender they were assigned at sex. So mm-hmm. it's like we're really seeing the affect and the effect of how these policies infiltrate our cultures and feed ignorance and hate and bullying, right? And so a thing that I think about a lot as an artist is a way to counter that. And my strategies when I was younger was to kind of try to get cisgendered people to wake up and to listen and to kind of take stock of our humanity. Mm-hmm. And I've definitely switched course. And now my work is very much about working within community, mm-hmm. for community, building these like really beautiful, enriching experiences where we're all bringing all of our full talent and selves to shine very brightly in these moments of darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, yes. And you know, that relates directly towards the next thing I wanted to ask you. Earlier work of yours seemed to be more singular. It was your body, and that was the medium. And then now, like with Human Measure, I'm seeing you with others. And then I know now you're teaching and everything. And I've been hearing you talk a lot more about community. And I'm wondering if this is like a new direction for your work to involve other people. Is it something that you're going to be continuing doing? Or was it more just oriented towards what you were doing with Human Measure in that work?
Well, there was Human Measure. There was also In Plain Sight, you know, which was...
That's right.
Which yeah. was a piece that I launched in 2020. With which was a coalition of 80 artists and 17 immigrant justice groups that were folk. Again, it was an act of solidarity, having artists focus their attention on for-profit immigrant detention and the U.S. culture of incarceration, mm-hmm. and really thinking about abolition and ways in which artists could support strategies of organizers towards creating possibilities for abolition in relation to immigrant detention. Mm-hmm. I think that after Trump became elected, this idea, as I said earlier, my strategy switched. It went from using my own body as like the personalist political, as an example of, you mm-hmm. know, a sort of trans subjecthood in which to speak to. I mean, I still do work with my own body, and I still think that there's a lot of you know, value there. Mm-hmm. And I certainly have done performances even within this last year that are singular and solo. Mm-hmm. But I'm also really interested in thinking about collectivity and, this making of a cyanotype, for example, which was initially just like creating a prop for human measure, but it requires like a 20-minute solar exposure. Mm-hmm. And it requires, you know, at least 20 trans and non-binary people to lie together in the sun, you know, like naked and holding each other, you know. I realized really quickly, like, actually, this isn't just the making of a prop. It's a project in and of itself. And yeah. So I made a version of that last summer at Fire Island as part of a residency with BAFO. BAFO was like a amazing queer, like kind of BIPOC residency program on Fire Island, which is like historically a very like gay, white, male sausage fest, you know? And the festival there is very much an intervention. And so I actually made a cyanotype as part of the festival, like live on the beach, and had the incredible LA vocalizations of Miss Dorian Wood singing with her collaborator Roku. And we then, like, instead of using water in a trough, we actually developed the cyanotype in the sea together. And then we like ran down the beach naked with it over our heads, you know, like screaming. And it was like so incredible. And I was like, this is so for, I'm actually about to do an action in Washington, D.C. on Trans Day of Visibility in collaboration with the National Center for Transgender Equity, which is it's like a federal organization that is partnered with the Trans Law Center. And they will be occupying the mall in D.C., historic site of protest. To actually target the first ever trans, non-binary, and intersex voting block. Like never before in our history have we targeted trans, intersex, non-binary people as a viable voting block. So this will be a huge action to raise awareness around this concept. And just like In Plain Sight, where I was interested in creating a sort of mediagenic spectacle, like providing a really beautiful visual to steer the larger public towards a social issue. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be making a 60-foot cyanotype on the Washington Mall with 100 trans non-binary performers.
Wow.
My druthers will be developing it in the Lincoln Memorial Pool. And if I'm arrested, then you know where to find me. where the day will culminate because the full day of action. We'll be hoisting this like banner, which in the context of the Washington Mall really references like AIDS quilt, references die-ins, and you know, also on Trans Day of Visibility, kind of refusing the like traditional forms of representation. It just kind of demarcates like the silhouette, you know. I think all of that will be like really powerful. So I'm super, super psyched to do that.
Oh, I'm psyched hearing about it. That's really powerful. I can't believe that that hasn't even occurred to me, the idea of like the trans voting block. Like, you know how revolutionary things are when it's like an obvious thing gets exposed I haven't heard anybody talk about that and the power behind that unity.
Yeah, because like if you think about it, it's like, okay, so trans folks, but there's a lot of non-binary folks, you know, like when I go to a university to do a talk, it's like sometimes more than half the room are non-binary, you know, it's amazing. So I think that this is going to be a game changer, actually.
Yeah.
An organization giving a space for positive action and forward movement is absolutely what's needed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's really incredible is the NCTE. They're like 25-year-olds. You know, it's like I am like definitely the oldest person in the room there, you know? So I'm like the artist lending myself, but they're, you know, and they're scrappy. Like they don't have money for a PR company, you know, but like I do. So I'll be lending my art PR to them. You know, it's like an interesting sort of weird thing where I used to be like the young artist who was like, you know, had no resources. And now I'm finally at a space where, I mean, I still have a precarious life, but I'm able to get some grants now. I'm able to now, you know, leverage my position and pour those resources back into those younger folks who are doing this like really important world building and like future imagining of like what it is that we can do. You know?
It's amazing. Right before we recorded, we found out that you did not receive the prep questions, and you have steered us to every single question that we have for you. So there's a, you know, your intuition is strong, Castles. This is a question that I wanted to ask about because you are now also teaching and you're interfacing with a lot of young people. And I think one of the things that is so inspiring to me in this conversation is actually to hear how you are bending time with the work that you are doing and bringing some of these lost voices into the current context and into these actions that you're doing with young people and also in the classroom. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious to know how the young people and teaching is reshaping your work.
You know, I'm pretty new as a teacher, so I don't know if I can fully speak to that yet. And I keep shifting institutions, so that's another thing. But I will say, like, teaching in Canada has been really fascinating because, unlike the States, you can go to, like, University of Toronto is considered, I think, the 11th best university in the world. It's, it's a research one, so that puts it on par with an Ivy League. And what that means is, like, it's a stellar education, right? Mm-hmm. It's also really inexpensive, you know, to go to this school costs, I don't know how much it costs actually, so I won't say it, but I know it's like incredibly affordable in comparison to US education. So that means that it's like totally accessible education to people, which is incredible. And that is so different in the way that the experience between the students are because there isn't that anxiety. It's been really nice to teach in an environment where it's not about money and where you can just like have these ideas. And there's so, the students are so gracious here and sweet and open-hearted, you know, it's like really beautiful to work with them. And they're like that in this, they can be like that in the States too, but there is like, but the cost of education really does influence the experience of teaching and learning, unfortunately. You know?
Yeah, like they're wanting to get their money's worth. There's an anxiety to that.
There's an anxiety, and I get it. I totally get it. But I do feel really excited to and good about creating pedagogy that insists upon, you know, including works that have not traditionally been included in terms of like the artists whose work I point the students towards, but also like I do physical, embodied, and somatic movements in my class. And that is nothing that I experienced when I was in school. It was all about the neck up and a sort of Cartesian model for learning. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, thanks to you all, I brought in Andrew Gerza, you know, for my musculoskeletal system. And, you know, we spoke about, you know, sexuality and like what disabled joy looked like, you know, and, you know, I've been bringing in queer Muay Thai fighters and meditation experts and people who teach like various modes of dance, you know, as different ways of showcasing how knowledge can be embodied and it doesn't live necessarily in the articulation through speech and language. It can come out in many other ways. And sort of, I think in having to kind of create these sort of templates for learning, it's really forcing me to really like scrutinize and think about like the sort of ways in which I've been programmed. Mm-hmm. And kind of take stock and question those sort of internal hierarchies that I have inside myself such that I can not replicate the parts of learning which can be damaging and reinscribing of these practices, you know, that we're actually trying to question and take down. So it's really like as much as I give out, I feel like I'm learning so much and getting back tenfold, you know? And so very challenging work. It's very challenging work because I don't have all the answers, especially in this moment, you know, like when Gaza comes up in the classroom, it's like, I literally want to weep. It's like, I don't have a hopeful, I can't put a bow on this for you. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes it's just about like holding space for that pain.
Yeah. Like you're not providing answers, but it does seem like you're providing this really wonderful foundation for them to be able to answer their own questions, to be able to come up with their questions and then maybe at least go in search of that. Like, so many different types of modalities that are not usually offered, or just ways of thinking, like you were saying about, like, you know, different types of like intelligence and ways to express that other than just like this mode of, you know, verbiage and written word that is like so constantly like given as the only way to be able to express your ideas or thoughts or things like that. So I think that's like pretty fantastic offering for your students, and the ability to then receive back from that creates, I think, a really great circuit to really grow and, you know, mutual growth.
Definitely.
Yeah, I love that.
And you were talking earlier about modeling expansiveness and holding space. Where can people find you? Where can they experience your work? Is there anything you have? I mean, you've already described the action for the Trans Day of Visibility, but anything else coming up that you want people to be aware of?
Well, let's see. I currently have a solo show that just opened at the Banff Center for Arts and Creativity. So if you happen to be in the mountains, go check it out. I'll be premiering this work on March 31st in DC. And if this airs ahead of that, and anybody wants to be involved, reach out to my studio. It's castles.studio@gmail.com. Likewise, you can DM me on Instagram, which is just castlesartist. Instagram's a good way to follow what I've been up to. I also have a website, but I don't update it as often as I should. And I have a large-scale solo exhibition opening at Site Santa Fe in New Mexico this coming November, which will be like a series of like four new installations, brand new works. So look for those as well.
Amazing. That's very close to us. I feel like we can make it out for that.
I would love for you to come. It's such a cool museum, and it's such a beautiful city too. It's really
Santa
cool.
Fe is wonderful. We should get out there.
Yeah.
No trip.
Yes. Oh, Castles, thank you so much for spending this time with us. Oh, I want to do something that I have forgotten to do in the last two episodes, and I didn't do it before we got on with each other. So you're going to just have to give me a minute to draw a card for you. There was one that just jumped out to me, so I'm actually not going to pull a random card. I saw this, and let's see what it's about. It is the mimosa plant. Yeah. Polisher of Radiance, mimosa. Mimosa the glorious, effortlessly showy, radiating buoyancy and care. Mimosa is the bright light and twinkling confidant you've been looking for. Mimosa's gifts are those of duality and nuance. For those who feel sunken low in their heart, slow and struggling for that spark that drives you forward, mimosa has the feathery swing of a mountain breeze. Mimosa creates the stability for your dreams to become realized without inhibiting the spontaneity and freedom of your imagination. Mimosa is a grounded and bright friend, the dependable stalwart mountain, and the breeze dancing on its edges.
That's beautiful.
So that is the energy we're sending you off with.
Thank you. I'll take it. I love that. It's gorgeous.
Thanks for joining us today. This is really special, and it's so nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. I hope to be back before too long. All right. Well, amazing to see you all. Sending you lots of love, and hopefully before too long, we'll see each other soon.
What an epic interview to wrap this season up on.
Like, just speaking to them, it goes into, like, I have to be very aware and engaged and just really kind of keep up in a certain way. But it's so beautiful and, I don't know, well put together, their concepts around the way that they're living their life and the way that they're making work in concert with themselves and with others and with what's going on in the world.
Castles is such a thoughtful human.
Yeah.
And this marriage, when they were talking about the academic space as being so cerebral and you're sort of just training from the neck up, and the fact that like they bring both the embodiment and the, you know, what's the word that I want to use for this? Massive intellect mm-hmm. their work is so special. But it also really got me reflecting personally on how I was raised in a very academic, my parents were in Yale when I was a young child, and raised in a very intellectual home, and mm-hmm. the body was totally ignored. You know, like I sort of pushed my way through my academic career in a very cerebral way. And it's like the whole second half of my life has been largely focused on somatics and embodiment. And it was like, gosh, what would it have been like to find that sooner? Castles brings together so much history, intellect, critical thinking, and then just the, you know, physical manifestation of these concepts mm-hmm. through their work.
Yeah. And then what you can't see on the podcast, what cannot come across that you can see if you look up their work, is then the beautiful pieces that come out of that.
Yeah.
With a lot of performance, I mean, the struggle with it, often like what we get out of performance art that is actually a product, like a sellable product, which is what we have to do in this capitalist society in order to, like, you know, eat, or I suppose you can survive sometimes off of grants, but it's still, you still, you know, have to negotiate all of this money. But Castles makes some really beautiful pieces from these. And sometimes, like, you know, the photography is incorporated into the performance. And so you're getting these kind of indexical remainders from the performance. Other times it's like, you know, there's objects left over, like with the cyanotype, or, you know, there's a piece where I believe it's becoming an image, where there's not only the photographs taken that illuminate the performance, like it's a dark space, and then it's the mm-hmm. flash photography that makes it so the audience can see something. And Castles is just beating up a giant piece of clay, you know, with all their might. And it's like, so then you also have that sculptural aspect left over as well. But so there's these beautiful images, and like even Castles is the times where they'll draw or make kind of representational paintings and things. They're fantastic at it. They're a true artist, and as we learned from day one, and mixed in with their sexuality.
I could have spent so much time on the like pointillism piece, like on the pubic mound. Like, I'm just like, wait, we don't have to go any further than this, because this is just like a deep calling and channeling of like a need to express and express through color and the body. And I was like, that is unbelievable. And I also love people who don't have their true essence beaten out of them by this world, because it is so easy to have that, you know, pure need to express in your own authentic way taken out of you. And I also just love that they are passing on a love of art and a alternative art history to their students that they're teaching now. And so I hope that they are able to continue to make art and to teach forevermore.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And I would say that they've been a real warrior in that aspect around their authenticity. It's been a real, and as I think we heard in the interview, a real struggle and a fight to continuously be their most authentic self, to continue along that that line towards authenticity, and to fight for others to have that right, you know, by making themselves incredibly visible and also incredibly available to these younger artists and activists to be able to have their voices heard and their bodies seen, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm excited about this trans visibility project because, oh man, if they drag that huge cyanotype into the water there in the mall, that's a historic moment.
That'll yes, absolutely. And pulling from so many important historic moments. And so I think some of this like angst that we feel or that we have felt or that you've heard from us on the show about, you know, lost history, there are actions that are happening in the world. There are people that are called to carry these legacies forward. I'm so honored that we know one of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to encourage everyone to check out Castle's work. And I'm so happy to be on this journey with you, Robin. And I can't wait to see where it takes us.
Yeah, I'm so happy that we've made it. We've done 3 seasons now, and we're looking forward to coming back for season 4.
Yeah, we're going to take a hiatus as we always do. We will aim for our hiatus to be 6 to 8 weeks, but we are, you know, we're scheming and possibly looking for a network to join. So there's always the potential that new exciting things that are happening with the pod could delay us coming back. So in the meantime, certainly if you have a podcast network that you think that we are a good or reach out to us, email us, fyapod@gmail.com. We're putting all the feels out there and the feelers. And we'll be releasing some bonus content and some re-released episodes. And definitely we're going to be keeping the TikTok and the Instagram going. So find us there at Fuck Yeah Pod. You can sign up for our email list so you don't miss our return at our website, fuckyeahpod.com. And we can't wait to come back and, you know, want to be connecting with you all between now and then.
Yeah, make sure to subscribe so you don't miss any of this and especially our return in season 4. And until then, fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah. Meep, 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 meep.
Fuck Yeah Podcast is hosted and produced by Robin Jennings and Sarah Tomcheson, aka my mom. Theme music is by She Her Sir. Segments are voiced by Kristen Smith Davis. If you're enjoying the pod, please subscribe and leave us a rating or review. And don't forget to share with a friend. You can email us at fyapod@gmail.com or follow us on TikTok or Instagram at fuckyapod. Thanks for tuning in.